Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Vaca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. Today we'll be discussing the coronavirus or COVID-19 testing kit. Why is it that this country hasn't been able to have enough testing for the rest of the population, such as South Korea or in Taiwan? And what's preventing that? So we'll be discussing that with Andy Lipson, who happens to be our scientist in residency.
And the reason we're discussing it, well, part of it is I am curious about, I did want to discuss the science of actually both tests, the RNA test, which is the RT-PCR test, and the serological test, which is the antibody test, because both of those tests are actually important to discuss. They mean different things for how we would really handle this virus if we were being sensible about it. And also, this is probably our first issue that has come from popular demand. Brandy, my partner, was like, "What's going on with testing?" And she goes, "Y'all should talk about it and what's left." And I was like, I wasn't sure, but then the more I looked into it, it's a real rabbit hole. I was like, let's do it, because she's a dedicated listener, and we want to respond to what our listeners want. And it is there's a lot of interesting angles on this, and there's some questions that come up for me that I'm not sure I can answer some things about it.
Yeah. All right. However, before we discuss today's topic, I would like to remind folks that we are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find this and any additional information on this episode notes. Please, anyone out there, if you like what we are doing here, please subscribe, rate, review, and share your favorite episode wherever you found this episode. Thank you. For doing that, we have been increasing our subscribers, and that is, I think, who knows, maybe it could be because people are quarantined, realizing that this is important to us and that they should subscribe, whoever knows, but keep doing that. Thank you. So, on to our topic. Right. I think where I'd like to start, just if we can delve into it, is that if we look at other countries, Andy, if you see South Korea, if you see Taiwan, the countries that have been hit before with SARS, the countries that have felt the epidemic, right?
Yeah.
Where it's not a pandemic, right? It's an epidemic, catastrophe, right? The countries that have felt the last outbreak of a similar virus that had been released onto the public, these countries seem to be better prepared than the other countries in the West, right? You have Italy, you have Spain, and you have the United States, which right now are the top three countries which have the highest number of death rates. And it seems to be that these countries are a little, maybe the word could be lackadaisical for the number of testing kits that are released out onto the medical staff so that we can try to figure out who has the coronavirus and who hasn't. And you would think that, well, I think a lot of people would think that the USA, being the greatest country, air quotes, on the world, would have devices to be able to figure out who has it and who doesn't have it. Yeah. Yet, we're finding that other countries, such as no one is talking about Taiwan, and South Korea, have some of the best testing out there, and have prevented. They did have one of the highest slopes close to China, but they also prevented a lot of deaths, and that's why people like Brandy, your partner, have wondered what's up with that. Why aren't we having enough tests? Mm-hmm. So today we'll be delving into that, and I hope that we'll be getting some insight. I myself had a difficult time searching for some information. I think there isn't just an information. I just know that Amazon is trying to create some of these tests.
Yeah.
But as I said, Andy Lipson is a scientist. Before he was a high school teacher, and maybe you can inform us on some of these.
Well, I think you gave some of your opening thoughts on it. And maybe Kenny, because I'll probably unfortunately I'll be showing a lot of stuff. Kenny, do you have any opening thoughts on what this what this lack of testing in the United States is about? Or
okay, so some of the questions I'm trying to answer are, you know, whether this is just the fact that, you know, we just weren't ready because we haven't had the experience. Is it a negligence? You know, is it a capitalism? You know, how much of each of these things plays a role into what's happening? You know, because, you know, obviously it's personal. You know, we are sitting at home wondering what's next. We, you know, we don't know when the economy is going to reopen, when, you know, when we're going to be able to live our lives again. And, you know, yet, you know, I have a friend who is now going through the process of the tests that I've seen, you know, firsthand of, you know, having symptoms and just waiting basically until it's fully, you know, it's showing the symptoms. And I don't know. I think more needs to be done, but, you know, I have more questions than answers. And I hope we get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think in my mind, it's a lot of the, I mean, it is those things. I mean, certainly it's the U.S. has little experience dealing with this, and the Asian countries that you named, including, and cities like Singapore had more experience dealing with this. But I also think it also is related to how close the state and capital are connected with each other, which U.S. is less of that. It's becoming more that, but I think free market capitalism is exposed here. Like the let it rip free market capitalism has really been exposed here by this moment. But we'll get into that.
Just before you say that, I mean, I hope that in the background of all of that, you have in mind that South Korea is also a capitalist country.
Definitely a capitalist.
They have 20,000 testing a day.
What I'm saying is
population.
State-run capitalism is different than free market, is a little different than free market capitalism. State-run capitalism is closer to capitalism under conditions of war, where the state plays a little bit more of directing the economy. And the U.S. has historically, the state has only just been there to help. You can see now the state is increasingly, with the National Production Act, getting more and more into the role of saying, we're going to direct production. But China and South Korea have closer to those sorts of state-run economies, which are what capitalism reverts to under crisis. But it is part of their history as well. So that's what I mean.
Yeah.
But all right. First, I do want to say something about like why these numbers matter. Because the one number people have been talking about with SARS-CoV-2 has been its death rate, right? How many people die? Is it 2%? Is it 1%? Is it less than that? And let's first ask a question. How do we get that number? How do you know what that percentage is? What's the number in the numerator? What number do you have to put in the numerator, the top number?
Death rate.
The number of people who die, right? We know that number, right?
Phone number. Yeah.
What's the number in the bottom?
The people that have been tested and proven to be...
The number, you know, the accurate number is the number of people infected.
Mm-hmm.
The accurate number. So if you don't test everyone, essentially, then you have no idea what that number is. And since we're particularly in those countries in Europe, the United States, where it's gone viral, if you will, you know, and the testing has been limited to hospital workers and people who are old and first responders and people who are in the hospital and some of the people who are being treated in the hospitals, that we know then that boosts its death rate well above what it really should be, because we're not testing all the different people that you would need to know. So one, because we're not doing any accurate testing, we can't know. There's no way of knowing an accurate one. The most accurate I think that is out there is a test that's done in Germany where they did an antibody test and the DNA test, or the RNA test, which I want to talk about both those. And it was estimated when they did mass testing in the city in Germany that like 14% people had some level of immunity to it, which meant they had already been infected. That's what that immunity meant. And the death rate they estimated was about 0.34, which is about three times the death rate of flu. So this is important. If you were going to say anything factual about its death rate, you have to know these numbers. And we know for a fact we don't know these numbers because we've so effed up this whole process. And there's two tests you have to do to get these numbers. It's not just enough to get the DNA, the RNA test. You have to do the serological test as well to see how many people have been infected as a percentage and then developed immunity. So yeah. I want to talk about both those tests.
And I think just by following logic, this didn't get here 3 weeks ago. You know, the virus, it's been around in our population. I feel that, you know, working in the service industry, there's people who have thought about it. Like, they were very sick, you know, unusually sick, and probably went through some of this stuff. And because we're in contact with a lot of tourists, you know, especially the people that are in, like, more touristy areas. There's, again, I'm not saying that this is a study of anything, but people are wondering a lot of these things, yeah. You know, what I'm sick already. And we don't know because we haven't been tested, and unless we show the signs. But, yeah.
I mean, there are some people who go back to remember people dying of people getting pneumonia when they were using the vaping. Some people think that those were actually responses to early infections. There are people who have said that. And there are people who think that this has been around even as early as October in China and wonder if it actually didn't start in China, that it started somewhere else. You know, so again, people, like, there's a lot of theories out there. I'm not saying I ascribe to it. It's just people don't know because the testing has been so poor. So why don't we get into some of the stuff? Because I do want to get into the test. And in talking about the test itself, the RNA test first, the test to see who's infected. I think we're going to be talking about the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in the United States. And I think we're going to be talking about supply chains. And I want to talk about both those. So what we're looking at here is the actual virus itself and the outside of the virus. And the outside of the virus has what you can see is this outside spike protein. This spike protein we're going to be talking about when we talk about the antibody test. And the virus itself is enclosed in a capsid, which is right here. And then inside that capsid is this RNA. And so there's two tests. The test that tells whether you're infected looks for the RNA, and the test that tells you whether you have been infected and you now have immunity to it looks at these spike proteins, and that's the antibody test. I'm going to talk first about the RNA test. That's the SARS-CoV-2, and you open it up, and inside is the RNA with these, like, proteins that help structure the RNA. And as you can see, as we get closer to inside, the RNA is not double-stranded. It's single-stranded, all right? And that's what you see there in blue, is you see a single strand of RNA. And that RNA sequence is what China sequenced when they first identified this virus. And they noticed that this sequence of RNA has sequence in common with other coronaviruses. And those regions that are common to other coronaviruses are the parts where they had to make little primers for. This is the part that they use to test. Because obviously we know these things can be mutated, so some of these things, sequences are going to change. They had to test the regions by making little primers, small pieces of DNA that they use to test for this RNA. And y'all should just stop me when you have questions, okay?
Yeah, I should remind our listeners that this is no way possible to listen to this. You have to actually watch this. This is a visual that Andy Lipson has decided to put on our episode, and you have to see it yourself.
You can find it on YouTube.
That's right. Or BitChute.
Yeah. Or BitChute, right.
So that's the RNA. Now, the test is called reverse transcriptase PCR. And the PCR is polymerase chain reaction, which I'm going to describe more. And we're going to be looking at this RNA. Now, you all know about this part. This is the, what's that, how do you pronounce that word? Nasopharyngeal swab. Basically, they stick a giant swab really far up your nose to get a sample of snot back there. And one of the supply areas that they're running short of are those swabs, right? That's one of the first crucial areas where people have been running out of things, is running out of swabs to do the nasal test.
And are these special swabs? Do we know that?
Yeah, I mean, they're just long. There's nothing special about the cotton. They're just long. And the reason, one of the reasons they fell short is only one company is making them, and there's such a small margin on profits for them, they don't necessarily make a bunch extra. So when they needed to make more, it's been hard to amp up. And the other company that makes these things is in Italy. All right. Also, the CDC went to this test, like, since this is a flu test, this is what you do for a flu test. But another company recently, because you know how people are saying you can get infected by just, you know, sneezing,
mm-hmm.
right? That means there's virus in your saliva. And there's another company which is recently doing a new test, which doesn't even use a swab. And they're basically just asking you to either produce, like, phlegm from your throat, or you can just spit into something. And they've noticed you can actually get more viruses out of that than they do with the swab. So this is a new test, a new RNA test that's being developed. Okay? So, and if you get no virus in the swab, the PCR can't detect it. Now, here's the first thing, that the other area that has actually been, so one of the ways, the first thing you have to do is get the stuff from that swab, and you have to extract the RNA, and you extract the RNA by putting the RNA into one of these little test tubey things, and then you add a bunch of reagents in there. Well, the reagents used to extract it are also in short supply, all right? And they're really, it's very important you do this right, because it's very easy to contaminate this thing with an RNA that will destroy the RNA, or with DNA that will give you the wrong reading. So one of the things that have been in short supply as well is the stuff that goes in this little blue tube. The other thing that's in short supply, and this is because after CDC screwed up all their tests that they tried to, the initial tests they made, they let LabQuest and another company, what were they called? LabQuest, or Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp, they let them be the ones who get the contracts for this. And they said, oh, we recognize your ability to do a reverse transcript PCR. And those companies immediately fell behind once they were overwhelmed with samples. But also the reagents that you use to store this little Q-tip and send it far away, because most hospitals are able to do this Q-tip, put it in there and do it at their own hospital. But the CDC was restricting hospitals' ability to do that because they're saying, we haven't recognized that you have the ability to do those sorts of things. So the CDC and the FDA were actually interfering with hospitals and other companies and other smaller firms or universities' ability to do this test, even though they can do an influenza test. So all they need is the right primers, and they can do this test. So they were basically making it so everyone had to go to this Quest Diagnostics, which is why Quest Diagnostics immediately became overwhelmed, and that's why California doesn't have a lot of tests, because they're sending all their shit to Quest Diagnostics, and they're backlogged 150 to 80,000. At one point, they had 150 samples that they hadn't done. So these are other problems.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll answer this later, but what is the difference between our test and the test they use in South Korea? Why, you know, aren't we using, or meaning the U.S.?
So,
you know.
Yes, good question. That test that was done in South Korea is essentially equivalent to the test that the World Health Organization literally, you know, released. The World Health, on the same day that CDC gave out their initial tests, and their initial test was wrong, had messed up stuff inside of it. Like, I think it had the wrong primer and was giving false positives. The first test that the CDC developed and put out, they didn't want to go with the WHO. And the WHO, like the day later, gave out 700,000 different test kits all across the world. You can imagine, given what happened with the WHO recently, and the United States and Trump basically saying, we're not going to fund you. This has to do with the United, I believe this has to do with the United States trying to go its own direction, and, you know, seeing the groups like World Health Organization as pro-China, pro-Europe, and as restricting the United States. So the United States tried to go it alone.
Just to be clear, the WHO test kits, those were effective?
Those were effective, yes.
Okay.
Those were similar to the ones they would have done in South Korea.
Yeah.
But the U.S. added an additional primer, which I'm going to show you the primer in a second, thinking that it would be more sensitive, and they just messed up the kit.
It, you know, one of the questions it makes made me wonder is how, you know, because I heard someone, you know, the speaker of the CDC gave an interview on NPR. I was doing a food delivery, and then they asked the question, why not use, you know, those other test kits that are being used abroad, and they're proven,
yeah,
you know, to function. And then his first answer was to say that we have our own process to validate tests, and that, yes, that process, you know, and, but then I look, and then they're giving contracts to private, you know, companies.
Yes.
To do these tests. So it's just, again.
And CDC and Quest Diagnostics have a very close relationship since 2013 of working together. And this is where you see the, in essentially, this is the state and the government working together, or the state and corporations working together, but almost in a more corrupt fashion, where it's essentially influence that Quest, I believe Quest Diagnostics has somebody, you know, who they know in CDC, and that they are very close to one another. They've got people on common boards and things like that. That's what seems to be going on, because when Quest Diagnostics was picked, that was also the day that they went out with Trump to the Rose Garden and talked about how they were going to be sending out a bunch of, they were going to be this grand new testing regimen, and they immediately collapsed under the weight of all the testing they had to do.
And to me, sorry, this immediately brings up the same relationship that a lot of military officials have, you know, where people at the security apparatus end up working in the, you know, weapons manufacturing, you know, industries, you know, Raytheon and all these, you know, companies. And again, we talk about corruption in other countries, and, you know, there's this direct line, right, of, you know, government officials that go one way or the other, you know, they go from the private to government and government to private.
Yep. Yep. So, anything else?
Well, I was just going to say something about the red tape of the Food and Drug Administration as well.
Yep.
But I think we'll carry on, because I think that you're going to slowly unfold more.
I think one of the things that's exposed is the role of the state. Yeah, this is an extracted sample, and that extraction process is very sensitive. You need what's called a reverse transcriptase. I mentioned that actually when we talked about coronavirus before. You have to add these nucleotides, CATG, and these primers are very important. These primers are little mini sequences that are made, that's supposed to replicate sequences or are be complementary to sequences found only on SARS-CoV-2, all right? So what they're trying to do is identify those sections of SARS-CoV-2 that are only on SARS-CoV-2 and aren't on any other RNA in the world. And they use those primers right here, okay? And they add them in there. The German one that was put out by the WTO, the WHO, had two primers. The United States CDC added a third primer and seemed to have messed up their kit. So this is how reverse transcriptase works. You take your RNA and you heat it up, and it unfolds like this. Then you see the primer right here. The primer then anneals under low temperatures to the RNA, and then the reverse transcriptase then sequences and makes a complementary strand as it moves across, right, using the DNA. So now you have double helix or double-sided DNA. One RNA and one DNA. And this allows you to do PCR. PCR is polymerase chain reaction. So this is just showing you what it made. This RNA would have been the RNA sequence that was found complementary to a, into the, you know, well, would have actually been found, not complementary, but found in the virus. And then the reverse transcriptase makes a complementary strand of DNA called cDNA.
Yeah, definitely our listeners have to see this.
Okay. So the thing to see here is that the technology for the polymerase chain reaction is very simple. What you need is this thing called a thermal cycler. And literally, you can go on eBay and get one of these for $400. Like, all hospitals have them. And as you can see, there's a bunch of cells in here. You don't just do one test. you can do like at least 100 tests in one thing, and it takes maybe an hour, 2 hours to do the whole
For the same virus, right?
Yeah. So, well, you can do 100 samples inside there.
Right.
And all will have their RNA and then DNA amplified to see whether it's RNA that conforms to the and the only way that you'll see the only way you're going to see a positive if you're a positive test is if that RNA primer matches your DNA. Okay, if it does, it gets amplified. So here's what you need for PCR is you need the double this double-stranded thing, which would be the RNA and the DNA complex together. You need this thing called what's called a TAC polymerase. I'll tell you a little bit about that. It's a special kind of enzyme that makes double-stranded DNA. And then you need those primers again, okay? And all right. So the TAC polymerase basically makes DNA goes over single-stranded DNA and makes a second strand of DNA. But the reason it's special is because it's a polymerase which only works at really high temperatures because it's found in bacteria that live in hot springs. Mm. All right. Then, so you take this TAC polymerase, you add, you know, nucleotides. All right. But here's what a nucleotide is. A nucleotide has a phosphate part, has a little sugar part called the deoxyribose. This would be the phosphate region. This is what connects to the other parts of the DNA. And then each of those bases, right, you've got thymine T, adenine A, guanine G, and cytosine C. And these have special associations with each other. All right. Thymine is able to recognize adenine with base pairing, which you'll see here in a second. And guanine is able to recognize cytosine, which you see right here, okay? And this is what this this is what happens when the two DNA strands come together, is that the A recognizes the T and the G recognizes the C, okay? And that's and then that polymerase just puts them, brings them together and seals them up chemically. So polymerase chain reaction basically just turns one set of DNA, double-stranded DNA, into a second set, and it does it over and over again, all right? One of the other things that was one of the other reagents that was hard to get come by after a while was that TAC polymerase. That's another thing that that laboratories have been running short of. And here's how it works in PCR. You basically do three separate cycles within that thermocycler. You raise the temperature and you cause the DNA to denature, which means it separates. Then you lower the temperature, and then the primers come down on top of the DNA, and then the TAC polymerase extends the DNA, so you make multiple sequences of DNA that way. And you do it over and over. Each cycle doubles the amount of DNA. So you go 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. Each cycle will produce multiple copies. And if you only started with two copies of DNA, in 40 cycles, you would produce several trillion copies of DNA. So that's the piece, the reverse transcriptase PCR test. It's a very common test. It can be done in any laboratory. And issues of incompetence at the CDC and really control and an attempt to go it alone and kind of arrogance, as well, I think, as supply chain issues that these companies ran into, really have, to me, have been the biggest issues for not being able to do testing in the United States.
So this is the test that people are lining up in cars to go to different tents?
Yeah, and that's where they'll be getting their swab. They're getting their nose swabbed. And then what's happening is that's going into a vial, and it's being sent to places like diagnostic laboratories, and it's just waiting there because they're in a backlog. And this is why it's taking 5 days, a week, 2 weeks to get the test results.
And what I heard you saying is that if there was enough equipment, there's no reason this shouldn't happen at more localized levels?
Right. Like, some people are saying, oh, don't decentralize because now you can't have CDC quality control. I'm like, what CDC quality control? They picked, they made a crappy product. My belief, and this is some ways, it's kind of like the story that I was telling about teachers, you know, just being able to do their own work. If in this case, if you just allowed places that knew how to do it to do it, that really would have released them to do a lot more testing than was done. You would still have supply problems, and that's another problem that exists. But in terms of this backlog of places that are testing, that are only done at a few places, I think that would have opened up earlier. So you would have had more testing being done by Stanford, UCSF, Kaiser, just people who already know how to do the test because they do it for influenza. All they need to do is get the right primers.
So at the moment, the tests that the CDC, well, this is the beginning that the CDC was approving, they were coming from like a few sources or just a couple sources or?
Well, the first test that CDC approved was the test that they made, and they sent them all out. Mm-hmm. And those tests were flawed and faulty. So literally from early February to late February, a bunch of tests were done that gave you weird results that people couldn't even trust. So people were running around with this virus for a month without an accurate test to be done. Yeah. And the World Health Organization was already giving out like 700,000 kits that were able to do the test. And none of them came to the United States.
And did they offer to the U.S.?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. From what I read the article, WHO didn't say anything and CDC didn't say anything. Mm. That's what I heard.
And what I was saying about the red tape was that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had received criticism in February, back in February, yeah, for not being able to approve the tests that many virologists had already found out that could test out the coronavirus.
Right.
I have just a note here that I had for myself that more than 100 virologists and other specialists wrote a letter to Congress on the 28th of February that said many of their labs had already validated tests for coronavirus that they could not run due to the FDA's protocol for approving tests during outbreaks, known as emergency use authorization. And this letter protested the FDA's regulatory process as significantly more stringent than required for every other virus we tested for. And this was a result of undue pressure on the CDC and state public health labs to rapidly scale manufacturing and clinical testing. So it just there in this country, at least in the USA, in order to get anything done, to have food out on the market, to have medicine, you have to go through this hoop of the FDA, and there had to be an adapted one virus test for the USA, as you said earlier, that would not be accepted by the WHO or would not be accepted by other countries unless it was approved or unless it was done independently by the USA, and one of those hoops are the FDA, right?
Yes. I mean, here's how I look at it, and I can't prove this, but I think the U.S. state has some very strong institutions, the military, the Federal Reserve, the police, those institutions of social control, and the ones that connected to the economy. But I think things like CDC and FDA are kind of kept intentionally weak. They're intentionally and essentially able to be manipulated by outside forces. Like the FDA is not some stringent thing that keeps corporate food makers in line. The FDA is a tool for them. They can get whatever they want from them. I think the same thing is true with the CDC. I personally believe that the CDC is arrogant and also had connections with other corporations like Quest Diagnostics, and they thought they had it covered, and they thought they were just going to work through them. And they were going to exercise control to make sure that their buddies, Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp, were going to make all the money off of doing this. Similar with the FDA. That's how I look at it. I look at it like a collaboration that was more like a conspiracy to make sure that the corporations that they're closest to make the money.
So I wonder about, you know, the issue of patents and if this plays any role in this at all. You know, like when they're making new tests, like can someone patent that?
This PCR test and RT-PCR has already been, I think the patent's already expired. All you really need to know is the sequence that you're trying to You just need to know the sequence of the virus that you're trying to study. Once you know that, and China released that information early on, then any lab can produce a little primer on its own that matches parts that they need to match, and then do the reverse transcriptase PCR. This isn't patented. You know, that process anyone can do. But the government is going to use the CDC as a way of saying, who's going to be able to make money off of that?
Yeah. So, because I when I was doing some research for this topic, you know, I saw some stuff where basically those first few weeks that the CDC was holding back some like universities and private and labs, you know, from doing their own thing. And they were, you know, they set us back, you know, and the availability of more tests for everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be clear. South Korea, in order to keep South Korea had a huge spike in cases. And what they did was they did a massive amount of testing in that early phase to test the people who came in and had SARS-CoV-2. But then, who have you been with? Where have you been? And find those people and test them. Right? They weren't testing just hospital workers and people in the hospital. They were testing everyone that you were around. So if a person came into the hospital and had COVID-19, right, and had SARS-CoV-2, an RNA test for that, then they went ahead and said, who have you been with? We're going to test all those people. That's exactly what you'd have to do in the United States in the early phases, is test all the people you've been around to see who has it and who doesn't have it, get them quarantined, then you don't have to shut the whole city down. Now, when you have no testing, you got to shut the whole city down.
Yeah, and I think this is definitely going to play a role, you know, the availability of tests into how we come back to some sort of, you know, normalcy, you know, and it makes me think, you know, I work in a restaurant, I'm in contact with a lot of people, you know, if I get it, I can get a lot of people, you know, as careful as I, you know, can be.
But there's a second side to this that goes outside of the CDC's, I don't want to call it incompetence, it's part of corruption, but it's capitalist corruption. It's free market capitalist corruption that's built on organizations of the state that are intentionally weak, intentionally able to be manipulated by corporations so they can be used as tools for them. And this is why the CDC was such a small-time operation and played such a small-time operation here, because they're essentially designed to be punks, and they acted that way, right?
A friend of mine who's a nurse in the Bay Area and obviously protecting her identity, she works and she is in she was receiving a lot of complaints and people trying to find information. That's her role, you know, and she's a nurse. She definitely demonstrated frustration against the CDC, the incompetence that, you know, she had to do her own research to give information to people. Because the people that are supposed to be communicating weren't communicating.
Right.
You know,
right.
Someone from, like, the, you know, an executive, say, from Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood, yeah.
You know, having to call and wait 4 hours to get an answer, you know, and, you know, these are people in the medical, you know, field, right? And then really not knowing what to do. And then the CDC recommendations are BS, really, you know, because they botched a bunch of tests too. And like the, so yeah, there's, I feel, and I've heard all your stories where there's a lot of, you know, just discontent with the way, you know, these executives in suits are, you know, portraying some sort of control when there's not, you know, and ultimately goes back to the workers. You know, there's also nurses in other countries in this country, you know, being exposed and completely vulnerable to, you know, in their jobs while, you know, these guys pretend to have it together.
Right. And the massive level of uncertainty people face when they have flu-like symptoms or it's hard to breathe. And one, they can't get a test because they've got the actual symptoms and they can't even get a test. Or they do get a test and they've got to wait for 2 weeks before they even get the results. No, it's just another way that the thing can spread, is because people, like, they're not really sure what's going on. They're not getting the test results. They kind of walk around and they had it, but they don't know they have it. Whereas South Korea, even China, were getting results in a day or two.
I was just going to say that another key component of this might be that some former officials from the former president, Barack Obama, during the administration, some former officials have argued that the Trump White House has undercut its ability to respond to the coronavirus by restructuring in 2018, a team that dealt with pandemics, known as the National Security Council's Directorate for Global Health, Security and Biodefense. And that restructuring of that office and undermining of that office and eventually the underfunding of that office has also been some component to this where there wasn't a specific department for, in this country, the government's department to be able to deal with an outbreak like this. I would imagine that if you don't have a department that is designed to deal with outbreaks like this, and you underfund it, or you take it, you know, you don't take it seriously, and you don't, then there wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't have people on the front lines to be able to deal with something like this. That's just one component, I think. And I'm not trying to say that Trump right here. I'm not trying to say Trump versus Obama was better. Obama was better versus Trump here. I'm just saying there was a department under the Obama administration that now the office was not has been slashed in under the Trump administration.
I read something where I think so. One thing that comes to mind is that there's no way they didn't know this was coming. You know, people at the top levels of government and the complete, I don't even want to say negligence because I think it's like deliberate, you know, disregard.
Right.
And, but the CDC apparently was hiring people for exactly pandemics and things like this in November, October of last year. They were increasing, you know, trying to prepare for this. You know, knowing that something was due, you know, and like I don't know. Again, I need to do more research to be honest, but I just find it suspicious, and it makes me wonder, you know, like what's in their minds, you know, and because some people argue that Obama would have done a better job, and I don't know.
I mean, this is where people who I look at this more like less than a pandemic and what is called a plandemic, where they see the United States working. That body you're talking about actually was working and collaborating with the lab in Wuhan back before it was brought down. So they were actually working with the coronavirus before that was brought down. So some people say that the U.S. had a hand in whatever was going on in Wuhan in the lab. So that's an interesting sort of thing.
Huh.
And
the story has changed. Just real quick, the story has changed that, you know, the security, you know, like FBI, I don't know who, or CIA, someone is starting to say that there is a potential that this came out of a lab. Now it's no longer the whole, you know, rat or snake story. Yeah. Now they're starting to talk about a lab.
Yeah. So I mean, again, I do say that the U.S. has screwed this. Well, I do see how U.S. has messed this thing up. I am not going to say that it's fully unintentional. Like, I do think there's incompetence and arrogance. I also think they didn't care. I do think that, because remember, some of this stuff rolling out was also happening while the economy was collapsing and the rich got richer under the stimulus package in a way that's historic. So we got to understand there's lots of moving parts here. We're just talking about one piece. All while this is happening was the collapsing of the economy and the stimulus package, which sent $4.5 trillion into the richest people so they could make bank off of a collapsing economy.
And, you know, obviously, you know, screw Donald Trump and the Republicans. But, you know, what were the Democrats doing during this time? We were on the horse of the...
Like Dianne Feinstein were pulling out their stocks with their... There were four people in the Senate who were part of the intelligence community. I forget what committee... But once they found out about the virus, they had themselves pulled out of their stocks, something like that. I forget details right now.
They had early reports that where they did essentially insider trading as a result of the political developments they were aware of, and they got rich off of it.
And the senator, Dianne Feinstein, is a Democrat. Yeah. So... I was reminded by that because Kenny said, what are the Democrats doing? Well, the Democrats are trying to live off, to make sure that they're not affected by this.
Right.
Or at least some.
they were completely, you know, trying to, again, play party politics and, you know, had the attention of many people on the freaking impeachment that went nowhere. You know, while, you know, there is all these, I can't believe that, you know, I can't possibly believe that Democrats didn't know that this was coming. It was potentially, you know, a disaster for the U.S.
Yeah. And, I mean, this has been political. And it's very interesting that the two blue state regions of this country, the East Coast and the West Coast, those sets of governors are saying, we are going to keep our places in quarantine as long as we need to until everyone's safe and things like that. While at the same time, Newsom is outsourcing all the testing to Quest Diagnostics. Like, Newsom wants to keep us safe, but he's going to outsource all the testing to a company which has already proven itself not capable of dealing with handling the load. So, to me, there are what I see at the level of Trump, at the level of Democrats, are these people are playing politics with this much more than they're dealing with a pandemic.
Yeah, of course. I mean, just to throw it out there for, you know, Newsom, he also, or his government approved, you know, fracking permits in the background of all this, and when people can, you know, nothing we can do, right? Like, even if it's protests, just mean, you know, it's just lip service. But even then, you know, like, there's nothing we can do. They're doing whatever the hell they want. And yeah, man, and again, yeah, they're playing party politics to show that, you know, they're fighting this monster in office. And then you get Bernie Sanders, Barack Obama endorsing Joe Biden and insinuating that, you know, there's this crazy president, you know, that, you know, it's any different than anyone else in office.
And I do think the battle is over whether the economy can be opened up prior to October and November. And that's really what the battle is. They're going to play with people's lives, both with the pandemic and really with the economy, to see who's going to win the White House. That's who these people are who run this country, you know. And that's Biden and Trump. That's Newsom and what's the dude, the mayor from New York? I mean, the governor?
Or,
Cuomo.
Cuomo, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, at the end, the Democrats do benefit from this thing being botched by, you know, but in making Trump be seen out of control. You know, and so, again, just making big assumptions here, but I don't put it past them myself.
And one thing I want to bring up that I didn't bring up, because this is where capitalism is to blame, is I kept on mentioning swabs, right? You see this thing right here? Like this?
Yeah.
This thing right here is the reason people couldn't get tested. So Brandy's using this to clean my back out, you know, as I'm healed from my wound, right? So just simple little thing is one of the reasons why we couldn't get tests, all right? So this simple little thing is the reason that we're in medical martial law and quarantine, and the, like, all of us, whole cities. And the two biggest issues around the supply of those things have been outsourcing and just-in-time production, right? And both of those things are done that way to maximize profits. So the outsourcing is done so you can get the cheapest labor anywhere, all right? So these aren't necessarily made in the United States. Oh, they're made in Italy. Oh, we can't get them from Italy right now. And many of these reagents are made somewhere else. Some of them are made in China, all right? And then just-in-time production means you have no inventory. You keep your labor costs low. You keep your space costs down. What's another one? Oh, and just inventory cost reduction. But that means that when suddenly you need to make a bunch of stuff, you've got nothing, all right? And so both of these things, which are part of why people think of the efficiency of capitalism, are actually part of what makes it, in a crisis, make it fall apart, all right? And so everyone who says that capitalism is so great, to me, it's like a raincoat that only works when it doesn't rain.
And it seems that the danger of this, and possibly the direction this is going to go, is, you know, towards nationalist answers to you know, to these problems.
Yeah.
You know, for our national security, BS, you know, and that we need to manufacture this. And obviously there will be perhaps bigger demand for some of these products, so there will be more profit to be made.
But, so, Andy, you have a second part to it.
Yeah.
Can we go to that? I'm curious about it, because I think a lot of people are wondering, What is it about the antibodies, and if we can be immune to this coronavirus, COVID-19, or
Right.
not?
Well, the really thing is that even though most of us are focusing, and even the news in the United States is focusing on the RNA test, the one that tests whether you have that RNA, the RNA of that virus. The test that really is going to be important for whether we can actually step out of our homes is the antibody test, because that's the one that says how many of us have acquired immunity as a result of being infected, all right? Because only a small portion of people die, even a bigger portion gets sick. Some people walk around don't even know it. They're like, oh, I felt like a little stuffed throat, or maybe I was a little raspy voice or whatever, but that's it. But it's very normal for people to develop immunity, and so we need to know how many people have that immunity. That test could be going on right now. You want to be doing that test right now to have a sense, and you wouldn't test like people out of hospitals. You'd be doing random testing to see what percentage of your population has developed this immunity. So it's worth maybe going over what this test is.
I heard that Germany is doing more testing of the antibody
They
tests
are. They are. Yes.
than the USA is.
Yes, and we have it. Again, it's just going to cost you. I think we're going to run into the same things of supply chains and availability of the test, but that testing should start now, random sampling. But here's what the test is about. So, as I said before, the outside of the virus has these spike proteins. So, the COVID-19 antibody test is an antibody test developed to these spike proteins. All right. So this is what your antibodies need to recognize to let you hunt down these viruses and kill them. So in this case, you have to get blood from somebody, and you've got to get a sample of that blood, and you're going to test that blood for the presence of these antibodies. All right. So your blood has something called immunoglobulins inside of it, and immunoglobulins are also known as antibodies. But this is why they have the letter IG that goes with them. Okay. But there's different kinds of IGs that. There are some IGs that you were born with. Those are called intrinsic antibodies. But the antibodies that we're going to be talking about are adaptive IGs. And an antibody basically looks like this. It looks like a big Y. And the top of the Y, the two arms of the Y, are the part that recognize whatever foreign stuff goes into you. All right? And this part can change. The bottom here is just the part that is usually attached to a white cell or a B cell, and that allows the B cells to consume whatever bad thing is inside your body. So, as I said, these antibodies recognize if they have a special part here, they might recognize something foreign and they attach to it. And then most of the time, these things are attached to like a white cell or a B cell, and that this guy is then activated to try to destroy this bad thing. In this case, we would hope it would destroy a virus. Oh, the antibody, that Y part can change. Like it gets mutated. In fact, your body intentionally mutates that Y section of the antibody, the arm parts of your antibodies, so they can have different ability to recognize different things. All right? So they have different shapes. And what you're hoping is that your antibody conforms to the shape of one of these bad guys out here. All right? If it does, then it recognizes it. And your antibody system is supposed to mutate so that you get to have different, you have to get these different recognition sequences that might recognize something foreign. So you take one of your, once you've gotten the blood, you take that blood and you put it on one of these strips here. All right? And you'll notice right here is the letter M and the letter G and the letter C. C stands for control. G is IgG, it's a type of antibody, and M is IgM. And this sample is going to, once they take a little liquid, all right, this sample is going to start where the blood is down here and run up the little pad. And then up here, you're going to see something that's going to tell you whether you have antibodies or not. Now, this part is a little complicated, and you would definitely need to see the video to understand this part. So here is the pad they're running it on. Here are the sample pad. This is where they put the blood, okay? And there's going to be something special they put here on the conjugate pad that's going to allow you to see the antibody. I'll show you that later. This M line is going to show you whether you have a particular antibody called IgM. And this G line tells you whether you have IgG antibodies produced. And all the way over here is the control, which basically just shows you the experiment's working. Now, this is the same thing, but shown a different way. Here's the sample pad, and here are your antibodies that are inside your blood up here in the top left-hand corner. And in the conjugate pad, here's what they've done. Do you see those little green squares right there?
Mm-hmm.
Those green squares are little pieces of protein that would be found on the outside of your coronavirus. Remember I told you that we saw how the coronavirus had that really crazy look on the outside?
Yeah.
That's a piece of that protein. What you want to see is whether some of these antibodies recognize that little green thing. Because what it's attached to, you see how it's attached to that, what they call that little red circle?
Mm-hmm.
That red circle is like it's something that when you hit it with like ultraviolet light, it gives off a red color. And this over here is just for the control. This is a rabbit antibody that's recognized by the control thing. And this just shows you that your signal works. Okay. So like I said, the piece, that little green square is like a piece of protein right here that they've extracted from the thing and they put on the pad. And they attached a little gold marker onto it that allows you to see it. Okay? So they take that piece of that protein, put it right here, attach to this gold marker, and then they want to see if the antibodies recognize it as they go across, as they go up the pad. Right? If they do, any of the IgM antibodies, this guy down here on the M line, that one has an antibody that recognizes the base of IgM antibodies. All right? So it attaches itself not to the arms, but to the base. And the IgG here recognizes the base of IgG antibodies, not the Y arms, but the base of it. So you have an antibody recognizing antibody, which is attached to this viral antigen, which is attached to a gold thing. If you see something red here, that means you have the antibodies. If you see something red here, you have the antibodies, IgG antibodies. And you should see something right here as a control. So I'll show you what a pad would look like. So you can see the negative one, which means you have no antibodies, just shows you the control. The one where you have IgM means this strip lights up, but you have no IgGs here, okay, that recognize the antigen. This one has IgGs that recognize the coronavirus protein on the outside, the part of the spike proteins right here. And this person, whoever had this sample, this person has both IgG and IgM. And the interesting thing is that these things actually give you information about when you got infected. So IgM is like the earliest antibody response you have is IgM, and it sort of looks like this. It forms a little macroglobulin that attaches itself to the bad guys, all right? And then that macroglobulin gets eaten up by macrophages. So this guy gets eaten up, but all the things attached to it also get eaten up and degraded, all right? And this is your earliest immune response, is an IgM. IgG is actually found embedded inside of white cells, right? And the white cells recognize the bad guy again and then consume it, right? Just like that, right? And in consuming it, it eats up the virus, all right? But this is a much more later response. A patient like this was IgM positive, great, you've got antibodies, but you must have been infected a little, like very recently, all right? If you had IgM and IgG, then that means you've been infected a little more, you were infected a little bit longer time ago. If all you have is IgG, that's great, you're immune, but you were infected, you got infected a long time ago. So you can kind of tell the different time you got infected using this test. But what this tells you is the level of your immunity and where your immunity level is at. Is it an early response or a late response?
How available is this test?
It's been made now. There's a company that's made it. There's companies in Europe who've made it and are testing it. Like Eduardo said, they're doing a lot of testing in Germany. They've done a lot in South Korea and in China. So it's there to be done. It's just not talked about as much. I'm not entirely sure why, except to say that the reality is that it's going to be our immunity to this thing that's going to be the basis for moving us through this. It's not going to be stopping the spread any longer because that door, that has left the building. you know,
yeah.
It's going to be the immunity. And so it's this test which is really going to reveal both the level of infection, it's already how far it's been spread already, and how many people have gotten some level of immunity. And because people believe the only real way we're going to ultimately get through this is what they call herd immunity, where the vast majority of us.
Which is what Denmark is trying to do.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily having confinement like this, like other Western countries are doing. They're hoping, and that one of, I think, of all of the Western countries, I would safely say that, except for other countries that are poor and underdeveloped, that they cannot, everyone, do confinement or quarantine. Denmark is one of the exceptions that are intentionally, as a wealthy country, doing this herd immunity by not telling people to stay indoors.
Because it would give you...
I should autocorrect and quickly say that. I don't know if it's Denmark or Sweden. So it's one of those countries.
I think it's Sweden.
Check it out yourself.
Yeah, I think
it's Sweden. Sweden. All right, it's Sweden,
yeah.
I apologize.
Right. And the thing that doesn't make sense to me is you would want to do this testing immediately.
Yeah.
Just to kind of get a sense of how many people have that. Maybe it's only 5%, but you'd know. And then it would also give you a little bit of a guess of how many people have been infected. And you would do this testing very randomly. You wouldn't be just doing it at hospitals. You would be doing this random testing to kind of just see how it's been spreading through the population. The fact that it's not starting now, I honestly don't understand.
All right. So I was just saying that one thing that keeps coming up, because I listen to KPFA and they do right now a segment where listeners get a chance to call in, and they're asking constantly, how can we get immune to this? How can we get, what is herd immunity? And is this similar, not similar in the sense that contagious effect of influenza, but similar in the sense that will this now coronavirus live with us for the rest of our lives?
Yeah.
Just like influenza, just like the common cold, and just like every other virus that we live with. And I think maybe we can wrap it up around there because, as I said, this is a very substantial video. Very dense, rather. Very informative episode.
I only have one more question. Maybe you know the answer. So if you get the virus, you know, can you get it again? And then is that intensity, you know, lessen?
Well, there's a few things I can say about that. One is, they now think there are three different viruses. They think there was an early version of the virus, and then there was a mutated B version, and then a mutated C version. So if you got the A version and you developed an immunity to that, that doesn't necessarily mean you have an immunity to the B version. So this is why you can get the flu and then get the flu again. You actually develop an immunity to that particular flu, but like we know that these things mutate and they change, and so... And vaccines are essentially trying to replicate, they're trying to boost your antibody response to things. So what they do with vaccines is they try to predict for the flu vaccine. They try to predict, oh, this season we think the flu is going to look like this. And they give you that version of that so your antibodies get developed to it. And then if they're right, then you're defended against it. At least that's what the idea is. If they're wrong, then it doesn't do you any good. Mm-hmm. So... coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2 is going to mutate. In fact, it already has mutated. And it's likely that a mutated version might make you sick again, but it won't be that same. It probably won't be that same one because you keep those antibodies.
So it could be more deadly? That's a potential?
Yes, could be. It could be less deadly. All these things mutate. And I don't think we know how the genetic code directly correlates with the types of effects it has on our body. No question it could change to become more like, instead of like a 0.3 virality rate, could be 1%, could be 1.5%.
Yeah.
So sounds to me that, like you said, Eduardo, we're going to have to live with this and find ways to function with that, you know. And cope, adapting, I guess, in some way.
I suppose so. And this is not, I think, this is, at least for myself, this will be for in my lifetime, this will be the first. And I assume that there will be more videos in the future. I mean, they're even talking about, as climate change is increasing, that there is now other videos that are now being defrosted, so to speak, that are going to be in our atmosphere.
Right. And I think people have to understand this is not, it's not new at the same time. And it is a result of globalization. It is a result of people traveling different places.
Yeah.
I mean, we know what that the when the Europeans came over to this place, it made Native Americans very sick. Right?
Smallpox.
Right. So these are normal. This is a normal part of integrating. The problem is I would say, true capitalism has no way of dealing with it in a way that's effective. And the only real way you can do it is to not be bound by the profit system, to actually truly share resources internationally, to not be caught up in these political games, which really what Trump is doing or the United States is doing right now, and I think he has the support of the U.S. ruling class, even though it's going to mean more people get sick, is he's saying, screw the WHO, screw China, screw them in having, they actually have things that we could use to help people right now. But right now it's about, you know, the National Production Act. We have to make our own stuff. We're going to try to keep China out of this, and we're going to get ready for war with China instead of ready to actually fight a common illness that we say we're trying to meet this global challenge. That is horseshit. The United States ruling class isn't trying to do that, but I also have to include the Democrats in that because they want to play a different political game.
I think you said in past episodes where, you know, cooperation in capitalism is a facade, basically.
Right.
You know, every country's at war, and I think we are witnessing a new intensification of, you know, what was already well in route, right? Like, what Trump is doing is only the latest actions of the world that was deconstructing itself, you know, and all these supposed alliances, you know, coming apart, because Brexit was happening before this, you know, and many other things.
But also, let's be clear, if we're talking about the international working class, that means we are going to be traveling around and integrating with one another. We're going to get each other sick. We're going to have pandemics spread under socialism. I mean, if we had that kind of revolution, that's going to happen. But you have this, I believe you have a society more organized around trying to take care of itself, and then not necessarily organizing itself in such a way that it has to smash human rights. Like South Korea is held up as an example, right?
Yeah.
But they also did this whole thing where anybody who had been caught, you know, who had it, then they had monitored where they had moved, and all that shit was disseminated. Like, that's kind of messed up, right? I understand, but I don't. Like, I think there is something where people have to figure out what the balance is between their rights and their safety. And we do many things where we put our rights in front of our safety.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a balance. I wonder what a social society, how it would decide that. I don't know if they would say, oh, we're going to monitor all this shit. If they did, I would have questions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Israel. They're doing that now. It's terrible. I think that that's a massive surveillance excuse for the capitalists to try to govern us.
Right.
And it's going to increase as we get more tech savvy and as other pandemics or other shock doctrine. It's the shock doctrine, right? Other disasters happen, other crises. Excuse me, I don't have coronavirus. That might just give us the ruling class an excuse to try to watch us, to keep us on the lookout.
Right.
So I'm terribly afraid of that. And unfortunately, most of the people, I think, are willing to give up their rights just to be safe, so to speak.
Right.
And ultimately giving up a lot of their own privacy in the sake of or in the name of being healthy or safe or et cetera, no?
Yeah. I mean, and giving up or losing those rights is not just an aspect of what people just associate with capitalism, but many people even defend it in what is called socialism under Stalinism, under Cuba, and things like that. And I'm sorry, I personally don't see that as socialism. If that's socialism,
right,
then I don't think you got anything. Like, I think you got crap. I think you've got something else. And I do think it's a collectivity, but I do think it's also about the individual being celebrated at the same time, you know, and liberty being celebrated. So I don't know. I would be really interesting to see how a working class state would deal with this, if that actually was truly controlled by people. But I personally feel people right now are all too comfortable to accept lockdown and accept, you know, just being quarantined. And I don't think that, I don't know, that to me doesn't really work. But again, we have to have a revolution to see whether people would accept, because we will be, if we had a revolution, we will be facing pandemics. After we quarantine Eduardo. Oh, quarantine him first.
We need to track it too, so make sure we go. Yeah.
Tell us your back. Friends. Who are all your friends? Who are you hanging out with?
Jesus. I apologize. So I have one last thing to say about this, and that is that I fear as well, not just the tech part, but I fear as well that the governments are using, as you had mentioned, the quarantine rules to be able to say, under any crisis, like they did with 9/11, under any crisis, there will be absolute control or total power given to the government to be able to deal with such catastrophe, crisis, etc. And that is what I fear. Because, I mean, you hear Trump even talking about it now. And he's saying, you know, total control.
Yep.
Again, this is not an attack on Trump. This is setting a precedent for whoever is going to be in the office, and that is Democrat or the Republican. And I assume that Joe Biden would think on along the same lines, that if this is a crisis, leave it up to us. We will take care of it. Do as I say. Stay inside. And then we have a decrease of people fighting for their rights, such as not having the right to protest right now, because there will be rules there to say that we cannot congregate because we have to be 6 feet apart. By the way, I should say that people like in Arizona right now are finding different ways, such as at the immigration center, detention center, where about 200 vehicles went over and honked and drove over to surround the detention center and honked in protest, and they were all within their own vehicles.
Yep.
I mean, people are looking for creative alternative ways to be able to still protest, and I commend people for that.
Yep.
But, I mean, 200 is not the same as having thousands and thousands out on the streets, which will now be, according to the new norm, will now be hindered because of the new regulations that are going to be in place, Democrat or Republican in the office, no?
Correct.
Anyone want to say anything about that?
No, just thinking again in a more like nefarious future where these can be weaponized. You know, obviously they're doing research and, you know, again, in a more targeted way to clamp down on dissent, you know, and because I think of places like Chile, you know, in Colombia, right before this all this shit happened, and now the state and those presidents, those governments, you know, the seeds of insurrection have been completely, you know, mantled, and the movements to restart and reorganize and learn, you know, because this is being done in the name of their safety. You know, at least that's the official line, even though, you know, they have a lot to create this the crisis that's playing out.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is people who are still fighting back, like the people at the Amazon workers who were trying to do something, and then the leader was fired because he broke quarantine. Then you have the McDonald's workers and Popeye's workers who were on strike and were blocking drive-thrus and things like that. And Brandy pointed out there was a protest in Michigan of people who were like, no, you can't keep us quarantined like this. And they did the same car thing. They brought all their cars around the capital of Michigan, maybe it's in Detroit, but they were protesting with the governor there, keeping the quarantine. So I do think that's an important pushback, because what is being set up right now and what we are being conditioned for is very worrisome in terms of what you said, Eduardo.
And I think, I'm sorry, Kenny, go ahead.
Just a case in Marseille, France, where workers at McDonald's took over the restaurant, and they are using the refrigerators to store food for people. Just so you know, that's one of the problems we're having in the community here. In the U.S., that a lot of food is being destroyed because a lot of community pantries don't have enough refrigeration. A lot of things are getting destroyed. And again, if we were had all of our workplaces, we could redirect, you know, the resources to be able to continue to, you know, feed people, because instead of just destroying things.
And add to that, Kenny, I mean, I was just listening that on KPFA that tons of liters of milk have been now just poured out, and eggs have had to be given. Strawberries being given to livestock out in India because of the exportation of other fruit. And, I mean, the food. This is the byproduct of capitalism, where if you don't have profits, if you don't have the driven profits incentives out there, so that this can the food can be ¿cómo se dice? distributed, then you will have an excess, a surplus that will only go to waste, because there is no, I mean, what do you do with it if you can't in the supply chain, something along the lines of that supply chain, there isn't something that is buying it because of, you know, a supply and demand, because of the economy. And therefore, we have tons of food being just wasted, going to waste, where we could actually use some of that food and get it distributed to food pantries. Lastly, I should say, though, that it might, what do you both think about this? This might seem like this is a moment of opportunity for the capitalist class to take rulership control, to take what they want from this pandemic, to be able to say, we're doing X, Y, Z because these are the rules now, given that we're trying to take care for your safety. But this also could be an opportunity for, I think, the working class, no? Where I say that, forget the moratoriums, people should start squatting at their homes. I say that people should then find that this is the moment to release prisoners, to say, you know what? This should have been done a long time ago, but now that we are having this disaster, we could now say, release the prisoners, release the thousands of prisoners that have been in prison for petty crimes or for racism, for discrimination, and people who could potentially die because of this. I think that this is an opportunity that people can start saying, well, they're going to look for an opportunity, why don't we? And I say that people should squat. I say that people should overtake the hotels. I say that people should take homes that are vacant, like in Oakland, where you live, Andy. Yeah. And there are tons of homes that are just being that are not being used because of realtors, real estate developers, just waiting for the market to go again, no, to run again. So I'm pointing this out because I think that this is an opportunity for us to organize.
Exactly. That's what I would say, that for me, it's, again, as I'm learning, it's about the lessons that we learn. You know, me and my industry, we know how vulnerable we are as restaurant workers. And so how can we collectively organize to not be in this same position, you know, again, and then further to take control of, you know, our, you know, way of making a living. And, at the same time, it's like something that sticks with me, that, you know, the Lipson said before, is that no one fights back when they're treading water, basically, you know, and, you know, there are heroic, you know, acts of individual, you know, resistance or fight back, but that's as far as it goes, you know, if we're not collectively organized and standing solidarity with each other, because in order to do those things that you're asking, that I think we will have to do eventually, But it requires organization, and it requires us also having control of like the food systems and supplies, so we don't go hungry, you know. And because, you know, I recently watched this movie, The Platform, on Netflix, Oloyo, and it's about, you should watch it. It's a social commentary. Basically, if you're hungry, you're not gonna think about cooperation, you know. You're gonna want to think about yourself, and that's what happens in our system. You know, us at the bottom, we fight for crumbs. We fight each other, you know, when they throw food from the top or, you know, whatever trickles down. And so we got to focus on moving up and taking control of the whole thing. But we start locally, we start small, we start with our own lives in our own place.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's, look, I would make a lot of money if I continued to gamble on pessimism. And on things, you know, going south, because things have not gone well for the working class over the last several decades. And some of the questions I'll have is, you know, we know those of us who know not to fall for Trump, do they then fall into the Newsom trap? Do they fall into the Cuomo trap? Do they fall into the Biden trap? That's the first question I'll ask for us. You know, like, do people fall for, like, you know, we got to go with Biden or whoever the Democrat puts up. And then there's going to be people who don't even have anything to do with that. But, and that's, and in many ways, those, that's my hope, is those people who say they're going to stay out of all that. They're not going to vote for Trump or for Cuomo or vote for Trump or Biden, whoever is thrown up there. But then the next question will be, under the context of a deep economic crisis, one that was worse than 2008, do we go at each other's throats or do we go at the capitalist throats? And the groundwork is set for us to go at each other's throats, for us to blame China, for us to blame immigrants, for us to not free prisoners, but to see black people as a problem, you know, or Europe as a problem, or Mexico as a problem. And it's the ability to get out of that trap. It means a revolutionary left has to be built that is not a revolutionary left that's captured by people, frauds like Bernie Sanders and AOC, because those people are going to deliver people right into the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party is about winning that fight against China or winning that fight against Europe, just as much as Trump is. And they want to maybe fight Russia more than China. So it's, I think the prospects to me seem grim around that, but at the same time, all this crisis stuff has exposed a lot of things about the system.
Yeah. I mean, look at this last episode. We had talked about the great equalizer that Madonna had said, right, in her bathtub with the red roses. And look at the disparities that now we are finding. I mean, in New York, the highest percentage of people who are affected by COVID-19 are Latinos.
Yeah.
In Chicago, the highest percentage are African Americans.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is that due to? I think that it has been exposing to us the disparities that exist in this capitalist healthcare system that exists, you know? So,
yeah.
Anyhow, I think that this is an opportunity, just like the capitalist class is looking at this as an opportunity for themselves in online distance learning in your field, Andy.
Yep.
And teachers should take an opportunity there to say, well, we're going to demand this
right
in the future and for future crises.
Right. It really comes down to, do you let them define what education and your society is about, or do you start to say, no, we are going to try to define that? And that has to be the way more people start to think, is that we are the ones who will be deciding, not you.
Right.
And you said it too, you know, maybe this is an opportunity. We have more subscribers, so.
We do have more subscribers.
Yes.
And to that point, Kenny, I think you're right. Maybe people are watching this.
Viva la revolution.
This is an opportunity for me to create my other YouTube channel. People are home. Anyhow, I think this is a good, I think we'll take it from here to wrap it up.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. You should be covering your elbow, Eduardo, by the way. You just touch your eyes.
Yeah,
see?
Well, there aren't any people around me, but you're right. I should be doing this, no?
You're gonna get slammed for that.
Jesus,
we're gonna have to edit that out.
That's why we're editing this out. Yep. All right, here we go. Well, that does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode on our blog, which is what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I want to remind folks that if you fancy anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 5 platforms on iTunes, Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Valco with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Livingston and Kenny Cepeda, also fellow socialist and community organizer. A big thank you to everyone that has made the show happen. Thank you so much. Stay safe and wash your hands. See you all next time.
All right, bye-bye.